You're listening to The Printcast, a podcast about the expanding world of printmaking today. I'm your host, Nick Naughton, a master printer with 20 years of experience in both fine art and commercial print. The Printcast is here to be an inky finger on the pulse of what's happening in printmaking today, bringing you interviews with contemporary artists, news, and timely stories from around the art world. Thanks for joining me today. Real quick before I get started, thanks to JD, Nina Jordan, and Luke Naughton for all becoming Patreon supporters of the Printcast. I appreciate the donations, and believe me, every bit helps. You know, currently I'm unemployed, as I'm sure many of you listeners are too, and the struggles that we're all going through are very real, and I recognize that many of you are enduring hardships in your own lives. So I am here for you, and I can feel for what people are going through. And, you know, the Printcast is going to be here for you, and we'll keep going, you know, no matter what new challenges arise. So also big thanks to anyone out there saying great things about the show on Instagram and Facebook. I appreciate you too. It helps get the word out quite a bit. And it's meaningful to see people, you know, posting flattering reviews and shout outs or just like a picture of what they're doing while they're listening. It's just like, I love seeing that stuff. And it gives me such perspective on what this is all for, you know, so keep that coming. And if you want to join my list of supporters of the show, just head to patreon.com/theprintcast. And if not, just listen, make prints, and do something that takes care of you, because that's what's really mattering right now. Today on the Printcast, I've got a special press-on style interview with the artist couple who run Calliope Arts in Louisville, Kentucky. Rodolfo Salgado Jr. and Susanna Crum run their print studio out of the first floor of their three-story duplex, recently updated with an outdoor garden and chicken coop near downtown Louisville. We talk about how the pandemic has challenged their ways of working, how they teach, and how they keep busy. They started a project called C19, which is underway, and it's a collaboration between a group of 19 invited artists, poets, thinkers, and it's with their studio, Calliope Arts, and the Artist Relief Trust, which is helping support area artists in Kentucky during this tough time. Our talk quickly takes a turn for the political, and we do talk a lot about the protests in their community and why Black Lives Matter are still pursuing justice in Louisville and across the nation after months of inaction by police over Breonna Taylor's wrongful death at the hands of police in Louisville. People will not stop protesting and showing up because there's a long road ahead before there's justice for her and so many others. I do want to give a content warning for today's episode because I believe people should know what's in the content they're going to consume if it might be troubling or difficult for listeners. Please note that while we still talk about lots of printmaking and things like that, this episode definitely contains a lot of political content and gets into topics like police brutality and the difficulties we experienced in our politicized environment today. So it's all in the news, you know, everything we discussed today, but I just wanted to put that out there before we get to the interview. We definitely had a lot on our minds, and so join me as I talk with Rudy and Susanna from Calliope Arts about print publishing, the pandemic, protests, and beyond in this special episode of the Printcast.
So we started this C19 publishing project. So we reached out to like 19 artists, musicians, and writers, and Susanna made some amazing tutorials on different processes. So we have, I think six artists doing lino cuts, five artists doing stone litho, four artists doing etching, and the rest are screen printers.
The proceeds of these prints that we've made are split between the maker, our studio to cover materials, and then toward this Artist Relief Trust. So that's an even split. The end goal is to provide emergency assistance to visual artists in the state of Kentucky and Southern Indiana.
You're listening to The Printcast, Season 2, for sophisticated arty types.
So I'm here with Rudy Salgado Jr. and Susanna Crum of Calliope Arts in Louisville, Kentucky. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us. Good to see you.
You too. So just for listeners out there, I met Rudy. I had a random work trip that took me to Louisville. And so I did the old like Google frantically for 2 days trying to find printmakers of any kind in Louisville. And so I found a studio, Calliope Arts, which has an impressive array of equipment and like a whole building. Like you guys have a really cool setup. And so Rudy and I got to hang out the one night that I was there. I was there for literally like 48 hours and I got in a good chunk of time with Rudy during that time. So yeah, I wanted to have you guys come on the show and just talk about the state of the world in a number of different ways. Yeah, and just kind of see how you're doing just in these trying and strange times that we're in. So let's start off with talking about who you both are and what you do down there in Louisville. Maybe, Rudy, we could start with you.
Oh, all right. Okay, so I have several different little hats that I fill here in Louisville. I run a Calliope Arts of Printmaking Studio when there's not a pandemic going on. We have members that are coming in. We're teaching workshops, and also I do most of the outreach for Calliope. I go to museums and do workshops or schools, that kind of stuff. Then I also just maintain our building and keep that going. And then I work part-time at St. Francis High School here in Louisville, which is a private school. Yeah.
And Susanna, what about you?
So I run the printmaking area at Indiana University Southeast, where I am an assistant professor. And I just finished my fifth year of doing that. I am also president of the Mid-America Print Council until October 2020, so coming on up. We, for those who aren't familiar with Mid-America Print Council, MAPC, we have a biennial conference that engages educators, art workers, printmakers, arts professionals in the field of print media, printmaking, and a journal and various other activities, exhibitions, and so forth. And I think Rudy and I are both really interested in artist communities and really helping artists be artists. So I think our individual art practices and our work educating kind of go hand in hand and connect in that way.
I think, and that's a little bit of our building, right? We have this like communal space where people are coming in and using our shop, and maybe I'm upstairs taking a shower, who knows? But it's kind of strange how that happens sometimes. But also, I mean, we have you know, contractors here working on our building. I also shoot tintypes here out of the building. We have people living next door. And now since the pandemic, we have quite a large vegetable garden and we have 9 chickens. So we've been kind of building a coop and kind of building, trying to just kind of foster this community, this creative community in Louisville, Kentucky, and regionally in the South, because I think the South is like lacking that kind of, you know, environment a lot, I guess.
Well, yeah, and like smaller communities in general, really, like when I think about where you're all located, like I've lived in similar sized towns and it's really hard to like, you know, mobilize an audience. It's hard to do something that you're doing because like you have to find all of the creatives who like want to use a print studio, or I'm sure you're probably doing this, is like you have to educate the audience so that they know what to do with what you guys have, and then they come and become like a patron of yours, right? Like,
yeah, and I think like one of our ultimate goals with Calliope is to kind of like educate the community on collecting art. And I think me and Susanna are both very like big promoters of getting people that are young to start collecting art, and investing in printmaking is a really good starting point for that because it's much more affordable. There's multiple, and it is such a nice like community kind of building aspect to the printmaking studio and the materials.
Also, yeah. Living in this region, you know, Louisville's a town or a metro area of almost 1 million people. So we find in many cases that Calliope ends up being the first stop for artists who move to Louisville. So they come over, and even if they don't become studio members and use our facilities, which, by the way, facilities in etching, screen printing, lithography, and relief, we end up being part of their initial kind of foothold or step into a community. And I know that that's something that artists want, and we see it. At the same time, in a place like Louisville, there aren't as many collectors yet. A lot of artists are working day jobs plus many, many hours a week in addition to fostering and furthering their studio practice. So we want to do as much as we can to promote, you know, the actual artwork opportunities for artists. And that's part of the reason why we're here, is there aren't so many opportunities like that yet.
Yeah, that's an important role to play. I can't remember, did you say, are you a nonprofit organization?
We are not.
No.
And that's surprising to people, you know, because we are practicing artists and we have other jobs. We don't want to spend all our time writing grants. So it's been important to us to be able to connect with other organizations that are nonprofits, and they bring us in on their grants. And sometimes we come in at the very beginning of a process. Like we helped the Community Art Center in Danville, Kentucky, write an NEA Challenge America grant a few years ago. We were the professional advisors on the grant, but we didn't have to do as much of the regular day-to-day kind of nonprofit work. So that's been our angle. And I anticipate having that kind of set up for a while because there has been such demand. Rudy was just brought in on a grant by the Speed Art Museum education team.
It was a really cool grant. It was like a three sessions of 10 classes at a time. And the first session was about with 25 refugees that spoke like 7 different languages. So we had like all these different interpreters there and trying to teach monoprinting. It was wild, but it's worked really well for us to kind of partner with other nonprofits and go that way with us.
No, that makes sense. Yeah, the grant writing process is laborious, and like a lot of it could be fruitless if you don't get the grants. It's like a whole lot of work to not move forward, you know, with your project. And then you have all the reporting and the back end work that it's just a lot of accounting and stuff that you have to be really accurate and precise with. And as a team of two, it's like you've got enough already doing everything else you're doing. And it's like not like you can pay a grant writer to come on staff or anything like that, you know?
Yeah. And if we had a board of directors, I guess they would have to meet us upstairs in our kitchen. You know, we live above the studio. So there is something very, this is our kind of labor of love, personal project. And we want to be able to approach it as fluidly as we can as times change, which of course they have very recently changed significantly. So I think it being, you know, we are an LLC. We're happy to talk with other people who are wanting to start studios and start that process of deciding what kind of organization they want to be. But for us, that's allowed us, because we're in a live work situation, you know, our home life and the studio life can shift and adapt as needed, hopefully. I mean, we've had chickens in the studio for the past weeks.
Which is awesome. I mean, no, if I didn't live in like the heart of a concrete city, like I would be doing the same thing. Like I'm so jealous of seeing all these people like starting gardens and, you know, we're all just using this time that we have now that we never had before, you know? And,
So I think like, you know, when we were teaching and, you know, we went to a virtual classroom, you know, things started changing. It was kind of the first time in almost 5 years that the studio has been open that it was kind of sitting empty. And it took us like, I don't know, like probably a month into the pandemic of realizing, like trying to come up with an idea or something that we could do and utilize the studio. So we started this C19 publishing project. So we reached out to like 19 artists, musicians, and writers. And Susanna made some amazing tutorials on different processes. So we have, I think six artists doing lino cuts, 5 artists doing stone litho, 4 artists doing etching, and the rest are screen printers. So what we did, we would make videos how to do this. I delivered stones, copper plates to the artists, and they make their marks, and then I'll process their plates. And we just printed the 10th artist print yesterday. We have a website up, and we're raising money for through the elevator. Susanna, you should talk about this part.
So this is another example of a partnership with a nonprofit. So in town, there's a coalition-led organization it's an organization between different organizations called the Artist Relief Trust. So it's has many collaborators across the state of Kentucky, but the end goal is to provide emergency assistance to visual artists in the state of Kentucky and Southern Indiana. So Louisville is on the Ohio River. Right across the river is Southern Indiana. That's actually where I teach. So we have kind of a two-state region here, especially for artists with working with their studio spaces across the river. So the proceeds of these prints that we've made are split between the maker, our studio to cover materials, and then toward this artist relief trust. So that's an even split. So 33, 33, 33, but some of the artists are donating their share as well. So we have so far donated over $1,200 to the Artist Relief Trust. And hopefully, you know, as we print more images and post them, we'll get more people involved. And we've sold art all across the US. We've been shipping prints everywhere and then having people come and pick them up as well, who are more local.
That's so awesome.
We reached out to Jim James from My Morning Jacket. He's kind of our biggest celebrity.
Oh my God. Yeah. Fucking love Jim James.
Yeah. So we sent a lineup block to him and some stuff for screen printing out to LA. And he sent that out back to us. And he's our most popular rat. He sold a lot of his prints, you know, regardless to say, but that's been really cool. He was really nice to work with. Ron Whitehead, Hannah Drake, there's some local Louisville, Kentucky artists, poets. It's been amazing. Like in the middle of this project, you know, all this, you know, these demonstrations have started, and that's been a whole nother thing. And it's some of the artists have, you know, kind of gone back to their plates and incorporated some of that into their plates. And it's been just a wild ride.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I know. I feel like there was like a before and then there's everything that will come after like this period we're in. And I can't feel the same about anything that came before anymore. You know, it's really been rocking my world, on every single level. But it sounds like that's an amazing project. And how are you just like social posting like the prints as you get them done to get them out to people so people can see it? Is there other ways how else can you get things to the marketplace now? It's all virtual, right?
We're doing a lot of Instagram posts, but we've done like two or three articles have been wrote about the project now, which has been cool. And then I think, you know, as of course, like lithography and the etchings take longer to print. So I think as more artists plates are printed and offered, you know, they'll be reposting and hopefully we could kind of continue this thing that we're doing, I think.
Well, that's great. So otherwise, I'm not sure what's the state of the pandemic in Louisville. Are you guys having a spike right now or what's going on?
We were doing really well. Our governor, Andy Beshear, he just started a few months ago and he was doing really great. Everything was going really well. We were kind of like plateaued for a long time. And then just recently we're starting to see an increase in cases. He for a long time would talk every day at 4, which was an amazing experience just to like, you know, have somebody there every day. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like the cases are rising. The schools, I guess, are going to vote on Tuesday to close for the rest of the year to in-person teaching.
Wow.
But I'm not sure. He's pretty proactive. I think last Thursday he mandated a face mask mandate for everyone in public. Mm-hmm. Depending where you go in town and where you're at, you'll see, you know, more people wearing face masks or less people wearing face masks.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of strange. I mean, I assume it's that way everywhere. And you definitely get dirty looks for wearing masks sometimes. People make comments to you and you're just like, well. So we've been doing a really good job of staying here. We haven't gone out to a restaurant or anything like that yet. It's terrifying. We know people that have had it and people's parents that have had it. And I don't know. It's just, yeah, kind of a new whole world, new world.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know what to say
about it. I have my views and I'm very liberal, progressive, pro mask. Yeah. And
yeah, there's no common, you know, there's no organization to any of it. So it's all, you know, we have people that are getting test results 2 weeks later. Now in Kentucky, we had a friend that got tested the other day and they got a result in 2 days, which is great. Yeah.
I think that, you know, so I'm from Kentucky. I'm from Louisville.
Uh-huh.
Rudy is from Southern California. And we met in graduate school, visited family here. Rudy wanted to move here. I'm really happy that we've been here for 8 years. But definitely I've, you know, lived in central New York, Chicago, Iowa, Louisville, and Kentucky really has a culture of, you know, the kind of rugged individualism and personal liberties. I was surprised, you know, when I moved back, we didn't have vehicle emissions testing anymore, like smog testing for cars. So there's, you know, a personal expectation that, you know, if you value something, you will do it. And if not, that's your choice. And that's something that is that Governor Beshear, I think, talks very openly about. You know, this is not a matter of personal choice. Talk to anyone in education or in healthcare, in hospitals. I have a family member who just posted. She's she works in hospitals and as a doctor, and she posted more about her experience and seeing more people in the ICU. And I think that, you know, in all aspects of life, we are paying, including the demonstrations, the Black Lives Matter resurgence, organized demonstrations. We're seeing people's experiences and kind of the veil lifted off in a way that we've been living in a country that is very inequitable and unfair and racist for a long time. And every aspect of the pandemic exposes that inequity.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so anywhere you look in life lately, there's unequal access to services and unequal access to knowledge and trust of science and all that. So I think, I mean, it's an interesting place to be right now with the continued lack of arrest of the officers who murdered Breonna Taylor, who is what this happened in Louisville in March. And I think that a lot of our friends and family are thinking about, well, what do I do with this time to make a contribution or make things better? And we've stopped looking to return to normal. You know, the normal is different. We're at a turning point, a hinge in our kind of existence with each other, our relationships with each other. So Rudy and I have been thinking about, you know, how we relate to others even more than we usually do.
I think, like, for me, I think, like, Kentucky, like, I'm proud to be a Kentuckian now, and I've been here for almost 8 years, and I grew up in California, and I'm glad that I'm in this state now during this pandemic. And the way that the governor's handling it, I think it would have been different with the previous governor for sure. But I mean, still, like, just this last week, the attorney general of Kentucky was taking the governor to court to upturn all the mandates and social distancing and all that, like trying to just cancel it out. It's just ridiculous. And the Supreme Court of Kentucky ruled in the governor's favor just the other day. So for now, everything's going to stay the same until it goes to court. I mean, it's just like, there's so much. Ugh, it's crazy.
Such a waste of, like, effort and resources and time and, frankly, lives, you know, like people's lives are being lost because of, like, just idiotic decisions that we could easily do in other ways, you know? And I don't mean to call people idiots either. It's like, I'm trying to just not be judgmental of people's differing views too. It's just like, they're not compassionate views. They're not empathetic. They don't take into account other people. Like, you know, every restaurant in LA, it's like, you don't get a lot of mask shaming, you know, it's like, it's a very different version of things where, you know, I went to a protest thing yesterday and it's like every single person had a mask. And I went to, like, the Pride March and it was like thousands of people and there wasn't a maskless person in the group, you know?
Yeah, that's awesome.
And it's just, it's camaraderie and, like, community spirit is what it feels like to me. And it's so bizarre that other people experience it in such a threatening way. It doesn't, you don't lose anything. You don't lose anything other than your ego. If it hits you there, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's just so much. I mean, you could just go on and on about the mask and the stupidity of not wearing a mask.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. But, yeah. So I feel like Kentucky gets a bad rap a lot of times just because we're Kentucky and we're, like, toothless and all this, you know, stereotypes of Kentucky that happens, you know, generally. And the whole – the voting thing was interesting for me, because like I had you and some other friends from the West Coast like reach out to me and talk to me and ask me about voting. And I think like after the debacle that happened in like Wisconsin and in Atlanta, I think, you know, there was celebrities tweeting about it and it was like voter,
Suppression.
Yes. Thank you. Like voter suppression.
Like closing polls and some of these things, right?
Yeah. And like one poll for a whole, like over a million people in Jefferson County. Like I get it. Like it seems like crazy, but also like is voting during a pandemic that has never happened before. I had several friends that voted that were in and out in 10 or 15 minutes. But at the end, you know, that there's a lot of traffic jam. And then that's when you got that video of all those people pounding on the doors to let them in. But there was also like over a month of time where you could fill out a mail-in ballot. I mean, there was different ways to go about it. And I just feel like we did a hell of a lot better voting than other states, you know, and I just feel like in a way, like we were a role model for that. But I haven't had the time to really like, I know Texas voted the other day, but I don't really know. I haven't been following. I'm in pretty follow up on the news a lot, but I haven't really had time to look at that lately.
Seems like from what I gather, like at least in Texas and a few of the other elections I've seen just reports on, that people are showing up, you know, despite the situation. And in a lot of ways, like they're getting record turnouts for like, you know, in between election stuff, you know, like like runoffs and stuff that like no one would have ever shown up for those. And like people are showing up. So, you know,
same thing here with the mail-in ballots, like so many people voted, like,
Yeah. I think if they had mail-in everywhere, like we would see like just a massive windfall of new votes and new voters.
Makes sense.
And I don't know what that would look like. You know, we kind of feel like everything's 50-50 here, but it's like, is it if everybody took part? I've always wondered what it would look like.
But I mean, I don't think Kentucky ever had a large mail-in vote before this, unless there's absentees. But like in California, I know a lot of people vote by mail. I think Oregon, Washington as well. So I don't know. You have to think about all that, but I don't know. Like I don't know. It seemed like it went better than Wisconsin or Georgia. So I was very happy about that.
Yeah. Well, so you have you guys allowed any artists to work at the studio, or has it just been like, have you shut that off, or are the artists just not coming because of lack of funds? What's it like in the studio?
We've kind of shut it down. And then as you know, different stages of reopening, like open, we would let like some people come and pick up their materials. Because of this C19 project, I've been doing like some stage etching with one of the artists. So they came in the other day and we went through that process, but we were both masked. But the studio is pretty dead. I haven't been making any tintypes as well. This woman had an appointment set up with me, and then last minute she canceled because her father just tested positive for COVID.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So I was just like, whoa, that would have really altered my next 2 weeks of my life. But, you know, so just like trying to figure out, we're super lucky. We still have, you know, like 60 to 70% of our income coming in. We're so really fortunate about that, and just trying to like help other artists in town with this project, I guess. But
Well, I saw recently I saw something like you posted like the finished remodel of like the second half of the building, which I think when I visited, I don't know when I visited pre-pandemic, it was like January or something.
Yeah, it wasn't too.
And it wasn't, it was still kind of unfinished on the one side. But can you explain like this? The building was super impressive. And I grew up in like an old like Victorian like house that we as a family restored my entire life, childhood growing up. So I'm all about like old woodwork and plaster and like, you know, respecting the architecture and details and stuff. So what's it been like working on that building?
The building's cool. The building is from 1885. So it's a three-story duplex. So we live on the second and third floor on one side, and then the print studio is on the first floor. Then we have some tenants that live on the second and third floor on the other side. And then we're still working on that. It's like a exhibition or project space / like tintype photo studio. That's still in the works. So what did I miss, Suze?
I think that summarizes it. This summer we have turned our attentions to the outdoors and the garden and changing the landscape. What's that?
I said we got a shipping container delivered. That was awesome.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
So that's to store artwork.
Oh. Yeah, put the plate shear in there because it takes a lot of the studio up. We don't need the plate shear. But also, like, we don't have a garage in this old building. So our bikes and our kayaks and all that stuff's in the basement. But also, it'll let us put, like, a greenhouse on top of the shipping container and the chicken coops next to the shipping container. So, I mean, we have all kinds of different projects going on. It's been really nice to, you know, print a little and then go out and work on the coop and then print some more or whatnot. So.
Yeah.
That's we were hauling rocks and big marble chunks in March and April that we got from a friend organization for free. And so we were just like doing all this very manual labor, like in between Zoom meetings and virtual class. And so it was the kind of, you know, exercise that we needed for sure.
Yeah.
Change in pace.
What's it look like for both of you to have to look forward to teaching and most likely like doing it from a distance for the foreseeable future?
I think I'm really glad that we did this C19. The project is formally called C19 Artworks for Kentucky. And that publishing project got us to make video tutorial demos, come up with kits for people to figure out how they'll make the project and explain it to people who had never done it before and simplify the process so that it would make sense and not be frustrating. And it would be something they could really like bite into. And so I think that was kind of, without really realizing it, that was a dry run in some ways, I think, to orienting toward a more virtual studio environment for the fall. In which, you know, in my case, I may have students have access to the studio on their own in time slots or like very small work sessions with me. But a lot, my technical demonstrations are all going to be online. And we are going to have kind of build community in a remote way and connection in a virtual, you know, through a screen. And so that's something I'm glad that we've kind of practiced, but it's not ideal for art education.
Yeah, no.
Where the social connections are the most important thing. The discoveries that happen, the surprises, and like delighting things together.
Watching your friends mess up and then realizing you're not going to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's gone.
And there's also this communal like, you know, the hardcore students kind of bond together and then take ownership of the space and like maintain it. And then they like talk shit on and like come down on like all the people who like ruin the blankets one night because they're just like they don't know what they're doing. And they, you know,
yeah, you need those people.
You need people like collectively like keeping this communal thing we all have to share running. And, you know, because you can't just replace any of the stuff. It's like it's really like you have everything, but it's such a slow build to like get a new etching press and then the blankets and all the materials. And then it's like, you can't screw that all up like day one. You have to like keep it for years. And it's so there's so much lost, like not having all the people in the room working, you know?
Mm-hmm. So I teach at this private high school, like a day and a half a week, 2 days a week. And a couple, like 6 weeks ago, they probably asked us if we were ready to go back, maybe 5 weeks, 4 weeks ago. And I think the majority of my colleagues were like, yes, we're ready to go back to the studio. And as I'm talking now, I'm getting emails from my colleagues that are like, I'm not so sure about this.
Oh my God.
So like, as far as we're supposed to be like in class teaching starting August 12th,
whoa.
But I'm a private school. I'm at a private school, right? And the public schools apparently are going to vote to not have in-class sessions on Tuesday. And I don't know how this is going to turn out, but the closer that it gets, the more I'm getting freaked out but I'm only there a week, a day and a half, you know, versus every other faculty member there is like full time. So, So I don't know. The two other art faculty just wrote me an email and was like, I'm not so sure about this. And I mean, being the artist there, we're kind of like, we're part timers. So they keep us out of the loop a little bit, but
yeah, I get that. That's like the plight of most like adjuncts, you know, is that we all just kind of are, I'm not even in that group anymore. I quit, but, yeah, you're kind of at the whim of a lot of other people who are at a way different pay scale and involvement, and they can just kind of speak for you, unfortunately.
Well, tomorrow is the meeting where the administration is not involved. Yeah. So it'll be an interesting meeting, to say the least.
Yeah, it's scary. Like, I just read this morning, like, you know, a teacher who basically had reported, like, a week ago that, like, parents are sending sick kids that they know are sick to school, and, like, the teacher has now died. And, like, yeah, I've been reading about teachers who are filling out their wills and stuff because they're afraid to go back, and it just seems... It seems crazy, and it, you know, not it's not lost to me also, like, the service industry people who are already, like, back at work, or, you know, the garment workers making masks, or the meat packers, like, all these people who just, like, don't have a choice because, you know, society really needs what they do over all other non-essential things, and yet it's such a dangerous thing, and, and I don't know.
Yeah, it's heavy.
It's hard. Like, I wish somehow, like, we could honor those people more and, like, recognize them more and reward them more. And, you know, it's weird. And teachers are definitely in that group. And looking at the coming school year, I imagine some places will go back, some won't. I don't know, you know.
Yeah, but if you think about, like, the transportation, like a bus, like, you're going to put 30% of the kids on the bus, and then you need, like, I don't know, you need, like, half as many buses. You need a shit ton of more buses. So,
yeah.
I mean, I just, like, how can you do that? You know, like, someone's at the door. I don't know what's happening.
Well, and it's sad because if people would just wear masks and, like, follow protocols, we could be like a lot of European countries where it's like, we actually figured it out and we have a system and everybody respects it and we can all actually move forward to reopening. Like, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, if the government would have got on this in the beginning and made it all organized and it made sense and everything could be the same. Yeah, totally. You just be like Europe. It's amazing. There was some headline the other day that was like, the poorest countries and the United States are suffering the worst during the pandemic. And it's just like, whoa. Like,
yeah.
And it's like the truth, you know, and that's hard to hear, but it's like, it's a mess.
Definitely.
And that's yet another thing that reveals where we truly are,
you know,
and where we have been, that the healthcare system is so fragmented and not evenly spread throughout and accessible throughout the population. You know, of course we weren't in a good place. You know, schools have been defunded for so long, public schools. Of course we're not well positioned to recover from something like this.
Mm-hmm.
So... and have more teachers available for decreased, you know, caps in student classes. So decreased class size. So I really am hopeful that we learn some lessons from this as voters and taxpayers. We'll see.
I know. Yeah. It's like excruciating having to wait for our next big election when it's, I think everybody's ready to just go. Like, and I just want it to happen. And then whatever comes after, I'll want to start dealing with that, because dealing with the lead up to it all is such a mess in the U.S. It's, you know, an endless election cycle and whatnot. And I don't know. How can we not talk about politics? Is there anything else we can pivot to? Like, or should we?
We need to talk about Black Lives Matter and what's happening in Louisville with that.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely wanted to get some perspective because Breonna Taylor was killed there. And yeah, like you said, Susanna, there's been no, one officer was arrested, but there's been no charges.
I don't even think he was arrested. I think he was fired.
Oh yeah. That might've been it. Yeah.
And he was fired because he shot 10 bullets into a building without looking at what he was shooting at, basically. And it was like, didn't they all do that?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
But
well, I'm sure, I don't know. I'm sure most people have heard the story of Breonna Taylor at this point, but essentially, like, what she was killed over was a no-knock search warrant, which is when the police just show up to a home, use a battering ram and smash through the door and basically, like, take the home by force with no one inside knowing what's even happening or coming and being unable to be prepared. So I'm sure it's terrifying and traumatic for the people who are on the receiving end of no-knock warrants. And what happened in her case was they stormed into their home. Her partner had a gun that he legally is totally fine having. And what he shot off, I think, one or two shots, and the officers shot 20 bullets just all over their place. And Brianna was hit, I think, eight or 10 times.
Eight times. I think there's 16 witnesses that say the cops didn't announce themselves. So, I mean, if you were inside that building, you would just assume that someone was breaking into your building.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, it's a mess. Today I read an article that she was alive for 5 minutes after they shot her, and he had to listen to her breathing and gasping for life.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was like 25 minutes after they shot her that they actually called the paramedics.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a paramedic on standby like there usually is on that kind of case. I forget why. Oh, what a bummer. But the other thing is they were looking for her ex-boyfriend, apparently, that sold drugs, but he hadn't been living in that house. And the police already had him in custody.
Yeah.
That's the part that gets it to me. Like, they don't have their shit together enough to know who they have arrested. And they're going to break into a house looking for someone they already have arrested in custody and then kill somebody.
Mm-hmm.
It's just ridiculous.
And then
it was within a row of other searches. So just one after the other with kind of SWAT team tactics, but not SWAT team training. So, I mean, as a whole, we're seeing this over-militarized culture mm-hmm. of fear where things go wrong really quickly and then things are covered up or not investigated, or, you know, like Rudy said, the delay in calling the paramedics. And this story continues to develop. And so we're learning things every day. But, you know, the use of body cameras also was an issue with something that came up during the demonstrations, I think in April. David McAtee was a chef in West Louisville who was shot by police and National Guard. No body cam footage.
Yeah.
And this was like 2 weeks after the LMPD, Louisville Metro Police Department, said that they all had to wear body cams, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think in that case, it's a similar situation where it's all on video. You can look it all up. That guy appears like he shot a gun. He shot a gun towards the police. But in the same instance, like, the police didn't seem to be announcing their presence or they were coming in, you know, like, but it's a mess. And I don't know. And shortly after that happened, the governor got rid of the state troopers. So no longer, like, the National Guard was no longer in Louisville after that, because they were just antagonizing the protesters. The demonstrators were getting shot at by police off the freeway, pepper balls into their cars. We have newscasters getting shot at with pepper balls, like, on purpose.
Yeah.
And there's just so much police abuse. It's just crazy. And it's all documented. And we have not been going to a lot of the protests. We have been working on this project, but when the protests first started happening, there was like constant helicopters over our house because we were right downtown. So we had like a week at least with at least 1 to 3 helicopters over the building at all times. And one night we had some flash bombs go off like half a block away, and there was a lot of police activity and people running, and it was like, it was intense. But things have to change, and I don't know.
Yeah, it's I don't think I've talked about it on the podcast, but we went to one of the, I think it was like the second protest in LA, like after George Floyd, like the week of it. And it was one of the most like jarring and terrifying things I've ever been to. And we didn't, I mean, going in, we were like, oh, hey, they're going to meet down the street at the park and like go on a march. And so we were like, okay, well, let's go to that. And so we went, and it was just, in the beginning, like, such a great feeling being around so many people united, like, about a cause, you know? And it felt really powerful to be walking with, like, so many people. And, like, everybody was being respectful. Everybody was being, like, you know, it was earlier in the pandemic, but like everybody wore a mask. It was just a really like powerful feeling to be with the group. And then, you know, like after we walked for quite a long time, like way down one direction from down, from the park, like as we're coming back, like we start seeing this like smoke, like these huge plumes of smoke. And we're just like, what's going on? But it was still like a half a mile or mile down the road from us. But that's how long the march was, that like that's where like the march had gotten to and encountered like a huge police force. And then I don't know what happened. I think like the protesters like super outnumbered and kind of bottlenecked the police in a way where the police ended up just like fleeing, and then all of their cars got torched and burned. And then later, like we ended up having to walk back to that same area, but we all kind of went back a different way. And then we get back to this one spot and like they start another cop car on fire. And that's when we started to see like the riot police like lining up, like holding a line. And then, you know, initially they were just like, you people are pushing this line up, you need to back up. And everybody's like, fuck you, and like freaking out. And then they start just shoving and pushing and hitting and, you know, just feet from us. And then it's getting chaotic and like it's starting to feel real dicey. And then like a car comes driving through like 10 feet to our left from like behind all of us. So a car comes just coming up through the crowd of people. It's like dense people. And like it basically plowed through all of us. It got to the front of the line. The police saw the driver, knew who he was, signaled at him to come through. And he drove through the line of the police and then got away. And then after that, just chaos ensued. And like they were beating people up, shooting people. Helicopters were flying in these like scary, like swirling swoops over our heads, like just to terrify people. It was really like the most freaky thing, having a copter like
right
doing like a 200-foot just hard circle like right above everyone. It's like it made it windy, it made it noisy, it made it feel just insane. And I don't know, we both, my girlfriend and I and our friend like who are there, just like we were all very affected by it. And I had never encountered such force like that, but it's like none of us had weapons, you know, like we weren't doing anything.
I think part of the reason that I don't go to protests anymore is because of that. Like I had a very similar experience in Sacramento, like in 2003, and the police started hitting me, and they started arresting a man next to me. He had his arms in the air, I had my arms in the air, and I started getting hit with, the guy started hitting me with his bicycle. And it's just like, and I get pretty angry really quick. I can see myself throwing a punch at a cop and being a lot more in trouble than, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Now, so, it'd be easy to.
It's so easy. And I don't know if I could, control, like if I don't know. I don't know. It's a shitty excuse not to go to a protest, but.
I think everybody's got reasons for any way that they're involved or not involved in all this. And I just want people to not. I don't know. I guess for me, I've felt a lot of internal stuff over the years, you know, as like every shooting would happen and I'd hear about it and I'd read about it and I would pay attention to like protests that were happening in some other city related, you know, but it always felt like it was far away. It felt like it was somewhere else. I never felt like I had any way to take part, you know, like I'd always sit there and just be like, I wish I could be there. If I could be there, I'd show up. And it's like, this is the first time where it's like, you don't have to be anywhere, like, you know, and you can show up in ways that like, don't mean you have to like go march with that crowd of people Sunday afternoon or whatever. I want people to wake up and acknowledge these things. Let's tear down the monuments. Let's like, just like take some steps forward incrementally away from the past that we never dealt with in this country, you know?
Yeah, I mean, we're still protesting here. The city's still, like, I think it's day 50 now. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm sure you heard in national news, like, they went to Attorney General Cameron's house and there are a bunch of protesters, a bunch of famous people, a bunch of celebrities, a bunch of NFL players. They went and sat on his front lawn. They arrested 87 people.
Yeah.
They were going to charge him with felonies. I mean, I made international news. They finally, like, let them all go and drop the felony charges, but they're still going to be, it's still on their record, like, that they had this thing that they're always going to have to justify why it was. But, you know, a few weeks before this happened, you had a bunch of mostly old white men with guns knocking on the governor's windows in his house. And then a couple hours later, they hang an effigy of him, and there's no arrest in that. So it's just like, it's ridiculous. Like, it's just still like, even in all this time of racial justice and all this Black Lives Matter, it's still like blatantly racist.
Yeah.
And that's a reminder that it's not, I mean, the protests and demonstrations are so important, but the work doesn't end when things aren't trending, you know, on social media. The work is constant, and it's specific to the resources and capabilities that you have. And hopefully everybody, you know, we know so many dear friends who are thinking about and getting involved and organizing to put their, you know, power behind and to amplify voices of people in charge of Black Lives Matter and of just social change in general in the city. I think that as artists, we're positioned to be creative about how we do that. I know we've had already two different parties, both associated with BLM, shoot screens over here at Calliope. That's another example of artists coming in the studio. So we've helped with that, you know, that kind of like mobilizing of activity. We have a dear friend who's on the art team, and they do projects together ahead of rallies and events. So I think that I've been really motivated by and excited by the amount of creativity and like image making, but yeah, also kind of inventiveness that's been coming up. People really putting their voices into actual things that we can see.
Definitely.
Yeah, I know, like
that kind of constant allyship.
Today in Louisville, there's like a pro police rally, which is wild.
Yeah.
But I haven't got any alerts about that. But a couple weeks ago, of course, there was this like white nationalist group that was going to come and take back Louisville. But the thing is, like, no, Louisville wasn't took by anybody. It was just, I don't know. It was just like they were going to come back, and they never showed up. They hung out. There was like 20 of them, and they went to some parking lot, and then they got scared and left. But it's so crazy.
Yeah.
We have a very interesting conservative kind of like Trump supporting neighbor, and he's like
he's our next door neighbor.
He's a friend of ours. He's an older guy. He grew up in Eastern Kentucky, and we have a very complicated relationship with him. Like, he always has his Trump hat on, and but he always breaks his bread and brings us flowers, and we give him stuff. And
in the pandemic, he was the third person in our relationship.
Yeah, like, really, he was like the only other person that we would talk to. He's this real big guy. He's kind of jolly. But like, when we were having flash bombs go off on the street, the dude's walking around with his AK next door, like just like walking around with it. And it's like, holy shit, Frank, you got it. You know, like, you know, I don't know. So then, you know, when David McAfee was shot, you know, he came out and was like, that guy had a gun. And it was like, well, we don't know all the facts yet, Frank. So sometimes we have a good influence on Frank, and we hear him tell other people like things that we say, and it makes us think about things differently too, which is good. I'm thankful for that relationship with him. It's not like every time I see Frank, I'm like, oh man, I have to deal with Frank. There are times like that, but in general, like, it's nice to have him there, and it's nice to know, I don't know. It's just weird, man. Like, yeah, he'll come home and we could hear like Rush Limbaugh on his radio. But then he's like, Rudy, yeah, Here's these flowers. Give these to Susanna. And I'm like, sweet. And then I give them to Susanna. And then we talk. I'm like, how was your day, Frank? Oh, it was good. It was hot. I was up in Indiana. You know, like, so that has been kind of like a weird, special relationship that we've developed during this time, I guess. I don't know. He got us really into gardening, so that was really good. And then our other neighbor got us into chickens. And that she works at this organization called Youth Build, which has been cool to kind of work with them a little through her. But I think, I don't know, like, Kentucky's doing this thing, like a governor asked everyone to put green lights up to remember everyone who died from the pandemic, right? So when you drive around Kentucky at night, you can see a lot of green lights up, like a lot of the buildings and universities, but also like just little shotgun houses. And yeah. So, I mean, there's a sense well, that feels good to me. Like it's unity at 10 o'clock every day. All the churches are supposed to ring their church bells. And I don't know. It's just such a strange time to be trying to figure out all the other shit that we have to figure out in our lives, you know?
Oh, yeah. It's
like you said earlier, the priorities kind of shift too. And yeah. I'm really interested in, you know, like we have to make so many less decisions every day, you know, like different part, I'm sure like different parts of our brains are working than they typically do. You know, that what happens when you're home this much, there's so many interesting kind of phenomena. At some point, maybe we'll see from an outside perspective what's really happening and what things are like. But it's definitely, as artists, I feel grateful that we have our workspace and our home and our garden and everything really all in one space. We've been working for 8 years straight to make that happen. But it really, you know, we have friends come over and they're like, oh, coming on over to the compound. And we're like, oh, what have we done? You know, like, compound. And it's in the middle of the city, but it's this kind of like isolated nexus of activity. And, yeah. You know, and we've been thinking about that more as an artwork in and of itself. And after having gone to places like Mildred's Lane up in Pennsylvania, in the Delaware Valley, River Valley region, which is really kind of like a 100-acre compound research art collaboration space. And yeah, what are we doing with our 0.2 acres in the middle of the city across from a machine shop? It's different.
Yeah.
But that isolation is real.
Yeah. But for me, it's been really cool. Like I don't like to go out a lot in public. So I've been feeling great. Like I don't get invited to bars anymore. I don't have to go out to dinner with people. So I've been really like loving that part of it, you know, besides like, you know, all the economic upheaval and all the sadness and death and suffering, you know, that has been pretty cool for me where I can just kind of stay in my own little head and do what I want to do and not have to go say hi to somebody that I don't really want to go hang out with, you know?
So. Yeah, I hear that. I think for, because I'm like an introvert extrovert, so I can like, yeah. I can hole up and like not want to talk to anyone. And then I can go to a party and I can just be like the most like animated, like crazy person. And I can't leave until like the host is throwing me out after everyone else left, you know, like that happens all the time. And yeah, it's weird. I feel like okay with not having places to go and not going out and like, you know,
saving a little money. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. I miss some of it, you know, like I love like good drinks that are invented by a talented bartender. I like food. Yeah. I like great food and eating it somewhere else, like anywhere else, but
not having to do dishes after.
Yeah. Yes. I know. I wish we had a dishwasher, you know, but all in all, it's, I think we're fortunate. We're both doing fine, you know, and we haven't been sick, and I think we'd take precautions to help that be the case, you know, somewhat, but you can't, what can you do? Cause you can't depend on, you can only do so much for yourself, but if you're in contact with any other people, it's sort of just like a crapshoot as to whether or not you're safe or you're getting exposed because someone filled up their gas tank on the way to meet you or, you know what I mean? It could be anything. The germs are kind of indiscriminate and, but yeah, I think it's interesting you're talking about your neighbor. My brother did a thing basically all of 2019 from January to December. My brother and his family, who live in Australia now permanently, they came back to the States and did like a year-long travel trip. And so they did most of the U.S. they covered. They drove the whole U.S. For many months. And they also went to like South America and different places too. But like they... one part of their trip as they were in the South, I think it was like around the 4th last year, actually, because they were camping at some just like, you know, little sleepy, I don't know where in the South campground, you know, and they were like, yeah, across from our campsite, you know, this huge group of people with like trailers, and it's like you can tell they're hardcore campers, and they had like little pop-up tents and stuff. They had all these like a whole huge elaborate setup, and you could tell from viewing them, it's like they were very like Trump supporting types of Southern Americans, you know, and which is different from my brother and his family. And what's interesting too is my brother doesn't live in the US, so he's almost able to see the US as an outsider at the same time. And so he's a writer, and he wrote all about just the interactions with that family and how he had preconceived issues and notions of who they were. But then like the guy came over and like offered that they all play a game together, and then they all like drank moonshine, and it was It was this cool moment where like they crossed over into each other's worlds and were able to see each other for people. And not have it be this abstract thing of like, you believe differently and I'm going to be suspicious of you or think bad things about you. And I think without contact, it's like part of the issue that we're all divided is we're not all neighbors with people who think differently, you know?
Yeah.
And it's so hard to understand, like, I don't have anyone I can ask, like, why do you have these beliefs? It's like, I have to guess and I have to go on the media telling me it's all Fox News's fault or something. And it's just like, it's so much deeper than that. And I think people just don't have enough perspective of like other people's experiences or enough room to acknowledge that other people experience the world differently, you know?
Right.
I feel like we rush around so much in, you know, from February 2020 to before, we were rushing around doing so many different things. We're not seeing the complex inner lives of, you know, the people next door to us or down the hall from us at work. And so I think if that's something that comes out of this is people really, you know, diving deep into the nuances of the people that they can't avoid being around.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that might be an important life lesson that we're not as, you know, it's really not black and white or polarized, you know, as polarized as we're told by the media, which benefits from sides, having distinct sides and styles. Yeah.
But yeah. let's see. So Susanna, what's going on with Mid-American, if you want to give a quick update?
Yeah, Mid-America Print Council is, we were scheduled to have our conference in October of 2020, but we have postponed that until October of 2022. It is going to be at Kent State University. You may ask why 2022, and the answer to that is it's a biennial conference every other year. In October of the odd years, the Rocky Mountain Print Alliance has its conference because of our even year conference. So to be fair to another print organization, and kind of to make sure that we're ready for the onslaught of visitors and things, to Kent State events, 2022 is going to be it. So instead, we're having a free symposium that will be on Zoom and some things on social media and other web-based platforms. And so that'll be October 16 and 17, 2020. And so if you're a member of Mid-America Print Council, which if you visit our website, you'll find that the membership fees are not very much. You'll be able to register and get a password and get into the many panels and demonstrations, many of which are kind of about remote DIY printmaking. So really finding more accessible, less rooted in academic studios, kind of ways to access print. And I think that along with so many things that we're thinking about at this time, you know, in terms of access and equity, being accountable to the, you know, trauma that we've caused, Black and brown and differently abled and transgender and across the board, you know, how have we excluded people from our organizations, even art organizations? You know, we're all responsible and liable for making things better and not just more inclusive, but more welcoming to all sorts of makers. So I think I'm hopeful that the symposium is really kind of interesting, dynamic event that's different than a conference because you don't pay $500 or a grand to go. You show up when you can. It's on a Saturday and Sunday. I'm hoping that people can arrange childcare, can arrange their work schedules, you know, to really access it in a way that they haven't before. That same kind of programming that we typically have. That's my long update.
That's great, though. That's a great way to pivot it and make it timely and useful for now, given that, yeah, like everyone's going to be battling trying to teach. And I think everyone needs to crowdsource like the best ways to like teach from home. To make art from home is one of the hardest things, unfortunately. But I think we've all got a lot of ideas and ways to adapt to it, you know. I'm talking to Rudy Salgado Jr. and Susanna Crum from Calliope Arts in Louisville, Kentucky. Thanks for coming on the show and sharing just like what's going on in your world and for talking about the wider world with me, too. I appreciate your time for sure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Good to see you again, man.
You too. Thanks for tuning into the Printcast. Thanks again to my guests, Rudy Salgado Jr. and Susanna Crum of Calliope Arts for coming on the podcast. It was great to catch up with two artists who are finding their way through this time. And they offered a lot of honest perspective, and I really appreciate that. So also check out their C19 project online at calliope-arts.com, where you can pick up some of the affordable works they were talking about hot off the press and support fellow artists with that same gesture. If you haven't done it yet, I always appreciate ratings and reviews on iTunes. And again, Patreon is a way that you can show a little bit of monthly support and keep me going producing the show. If you want to join up, it's as little as $3 a month at patreon.com/theprintcast. Thanks for listening to the show, and I'll see y'all next time.
You've been listening to The Printcast, a podcast about print shops, the artist, the process, and all the things we make. If you like what you're listening to, help us get the word out by subscribing and leaving a 5-star review and sharing with your friends on social media. You can find The Printcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, as well as on the website printcast.com. Music for the show is by Jazar. Voiceover provided by Jim Birdsall and Rhiannon Birdsall. Take care of yourselves and each other, and we'll see you again on another episode of The Printcast. Bye for now.